Britain, decline or renewal? Why the future will be different? The transition from Queen Elizabeth, the longest-serving monarch in British history, to King Charles III will prove to be a historic moment. Indeed, an end of an era. Not just that of Queen Elizabeth, but also, at least equally important, the end of post-imperial Britain. Let me explain that. Britain was an empire from the 17th to the mid-20th century. The end of the empire was slow but clear. And the moment the empire came to an end was in 1956 at the Suez Crisis, when it became clear that Britain had lost not only the resources of an empire, the reach of an empire, but also the will to be an empire. Yet the 7 decades since that moment, since the end of the empire, basically the period from the late 1950s to the 2010s, were a success. Britain found a new place in the world for itself. Britain became a solid military power, never acting alone, always in cooperation with the United States, but still with its own major military resources, including a credible nuclear arsenal. Economically, the 1960s, the 1970s were far from easy. But by the 1980s, Britain was beyond the difficulties and rationing of the years after the Second World War. Britain became open to business and did attract colossal levels of investments. Margaret Thatcher's highly liberal economic policies, especially in liberalizing industries, privatizing many major state assets, and opening the UK's financial markets to international banks, mainly American banks, transformed the economy. London became the second most important financial center in the world, and by some standards, even more important than New York. Capital, talent, and the many industries that service them flocked to London. The UK was running ahead at a time when many European countries were hardly moving. In the 1990s, the first 10 or 15 years of the 2000s, the UK enjoyed a sense of achievement, of success. There was an inherent, pervading self-confidence. There were real foundations behind the success, behind the self-confidence. Economic growth in Britain was solid. Investment continued to pour in even after the 2008 financial crisis. Some British industries, especially in advanced sciences and technologies, as well as in art and entertainment, were achieving immense success. And before and after, Britain continued to be a place where democracy is extremely solid. Freedoms and rights are protected to the highest level anywhere in the world. And it was one of the very few places where the ultra-rich from all over the world choose to park their money and purchase assets and send their kids to study and live. And with all of that, Britain retained a sense of nostalgia to a history that many in the world loved and admired, some even envied. A history of grand country houses in idyllic, beautiful, serene countryside, lords and ladies living high, velvety, sumptuous lives. A history of chivalrous, aristocratic, refined manners, all punctuated by wealth and grandeur. History punctuated by beauty. Of course, at the very heart of all of this, there was an imagined, rather than remembered, history. An image imagined rather than an image preserved. But if the images are powerful, entrenched, and seductive, they come to form a reality in the minds. This Britishness, or perhaps Englishness, seeped into the minds of many in the UK and abroad. This endowed Britain with a soft power that very few countries, if any at all, enjoyed. And yet, four problems were growing beneath the surface. First, inequality. A major gap has opened up between the haves in the UK, the dwellers of select neighborhoods in London, and the commuter belt towns around it, many of whom actually are non-British, and the richest of them are largely visiting the country rather than living in it, as opposed to the rest of the population of the UK. The second problem, there was a slow but clear descent in politics. Not merely in the quality of politicians on all sides, but crucially in the way politics was being conducted. There was a sense of lack of seriousness, of the evaporation of meaning, the rise of mediocrity, and slow descent in the sense of show business becoming the real game in town at the expense of substance in politics. Third, the acute weakening of mass media across the world, of course, in favor of niche substrata of social media, diluted the central messages coming from the center, from the elite, from London, in favor of strengthening subcultures coming from poorer areas of the UK, from poorer sections of the British society. These subcultures have always been at the core of British sociopolitics, but in the past 20 years or so, they have come strongly to the surface, and the more they appeared, the more they acquired confidence, the more they became mainstream, and the result was a marked change in British culture, many would say, with the bar moving lower and lower. And then there was Brexit. Britain's exit from the European Union did not really change its foreign policy, nor did it change its strategic positioning in the world. But it has changed its anchors, its direction of looking abroad, and the way the institutions of the state function. Brexit was not really a shock. The anger and desire for change that were behind it had been years in the making. But indeed, Brexit was a major change of direction of energy, of resources. Such change imposes costs on institutions and on society. Amidst all of these changes and transformations, there has been a sense, a feeling, that Britain is undergoing a serious transition towards a different future. That what is coming will be different from what was in the past 30 or 40 years. Indeed, Britain's future will be different from its recent past. This series will trace, present, and analyze the key variables that will determine that future.